Welcome to the Social Science of War. This podcast is brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. We bring together scholars and practitioners to better understand warfare, the Army, and national security strategy. The views expressed in this episode do not represent the views of West Point or any agency of the U.S. government. We hope you enjoy the show. Today's episode is the conclusion of our two-part series with Dr. Ike Wilson, a 20-year retrospective on America's war in Iraq. If you have not listened to Part 1, we highly recommend you do so by going to the previous episode on our podcast feed. In Part 1, we cover the outset of the war in Iraq through the 10-year anniversary. Today, we pick up where we left off and continue our discussion on security force assistance brigades before Dr. Wilson challenges the next generation of military and civilian leaders to consider how we can close with and restore peace and governance in places like Iraq once major combat operations cease. This fascinating discussion includes a story of how research and scholarship played a role in finding and capturing Saddam Hussein and Tikrit. Finally, we conclude with a critical look at force protection in the Middle East today, as Dr. Wilson calls for a redefining of America's mission across the region. Without further ado, here is part two of my interview with Dr. Ike Wilson.
You know, we've covered a lot on the SFAB in the command itself, a division-level command that has headquartering responsibilities for multiple SFABs, the brigades themselves, you know, 800-ish man strong, but as we talked about the last time, in my assessment, not strong enough. The instinct to create them, really born of a lot of some of the positive lessons not only gathered, but genuinely attempted to learn, move them into organizational and operational redesign, doctrinal redesign, and a doctrinal redesign that's actually happening in military humanitarian operations and, frankly, conflict battle spaces ongoing since their inception organizationally in 2017. Again, a birth child of modularization, the General Shinseki initiative during his tenure as chief of staff of the Army, an effort that we were actually transforming under fire starting in the first year of the Iraq War, 2003. We were conducting combat operations and at the same time initiating some of the early parts of unit reorganization under transformation and modularization. I think the SFAB as a module is the right organizing principle, as we talked about last time. Too anemic, a bit too anemic in terms of what we see and conceive of as its baseline manning organizational structure, and what we're going to therefore be willing and able to resource in terms of personnel, leadership, and education and training into that model, those key elements of the DOTMIL PF force development and force management and modernization model. I have severe concerns there as well. One positive lesson I think we're possibly on the right track is, again, SFABs are really kind of born historically out of special operations, and more specifically, Army special operations and special forces. They have a heritage that goes back to the MACV years and experiences during Vietnam. Train, advise, and assist. So the ability to have a conventional SFAB element for the conventional force of the unconventional doctrinal practices and training requirements of foreign internal defense and unconventional warfare, but that being done to scale, the SFAB, a very positive lessons gathered, and we'll see how much it manifests for real, impactful, operational, and strategic level learning, a reinforcement to what SOF's always brought to the table in terms of one of its 12 core activities and core mission sets. I would call it a core competency, frankly, even larger when you think about joint combined SOF. Being able to have a conventional parallel to that so that SOF can begin to, you know, do what it's always done, be the vanguard in these training, advisory, and assistance and accompaniment roles. For example, circa the first days, weeks, and months in the wake of the so-called Islamic State's violent incursion of Mosul and the violation of the international boundary between Syria and Iraq, two sovereign nation states. That initial push was, as it always is, by special operations forces, and that mission pretty rapidly evolving into a parallel set of missions of direct action, counterterrorism, but also at the beginning of train, advise, assist, and accompaniment as we help the Iraqi forces and the Syrian Democratic Forces to build up. That actually gives us organizational units in all the DOTMIL PF that comes with that, to provide bridges against that broad, enduring chasm, a chasm that's long haunted military operations and military affairs, not only of the U.S., but of all of our allies and partners. I mean, frankly, it goes even beyond the paradox of the Western way of peace and warfare. I mean, I think it's something that haunts political military affairs writ large, and not only political military affairs, but civilian military humanitarian affairs.
Yeah, right. So maybe it's right-sized and right-manned for SOF for smaller scale, and you're saying, why not take those lessons learned and now expand it, right-size it for conventional phase three, phase four, if we're going to do another Iraq or Afghanistan again?
Or if another Iraq or Afghanistan come and find us. And that could be the next one of those, even though we say we shouldn't go out seeking those kind of monsters to destroy again. Full agreement with that. But sometimes those monsters find us. The next Iraq and Afghanistan might be already playing out, and we might be calling it Israel Hamas.
Right.
All right. It might be portending to come in a GCCP in Taiwan and the metastasis that can occur from there. Strong arguments that we are 2 years into a similar situation called Putin's Russia and Ukraine. Right. We have lots of pitiable examples of this. We have one boiling right now again. I think this counts number 7 or number 8 since the country became an independent sovereign country, the country of Haiti. We're right there again in our confused and confusing compound relationship between the United States of America and Haiti, becoming another vector, adding to the compound security dilemma that rests and resides and threatens the U.S. southern border, the global south here in the Western Hemisphere. Lots to think about, but organizationally and operationally, I mean, it's usually hard to get this out of me, right? I've seen more lessons gathered, not yet learned in the last, 39 years of my experience of thinking, teaching, and doing this stuff. I'm hopeful in terms of the SFAB construct and its potential for giving the United States and our allies and partners a go-to industrial scale equivalent for the conventional, long-term steady state operations of a phase four stability and reconstruction operation that resides and has long resided as a core competency and a core activity within our special operations forces on the unconventional side of the house. It's a place organization operationally where so-called irregular warfare can actually do its job from a political purpose standpoint of winning without fighting or short of conflict. And at the same time, having a bridging capability between the irregular warfare activities and that bridging over in the conventional force.
Sir, allow me to play devil's advocate. Not that I necessarily am advocating for this position, right? But if I were to counter argue that, hey, that's not what the Army does best. What we do is we destroy the enemy. That's what we do best. So we are not the organization to do these things. And then, of course, the buzzword throughout this whole period of time that everyone uses as the attack vector is nation building. The Army, this is not something we ought to be doing. What say you? How do you respond to that counter argument?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I love and hate that question. It's a question that's haunted me, again, certainly throughout the Iraq, my experiences with the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Two or three things to say real quick. First, I would say I would counter to that counter. The military does whatever the nation tells it to do. Just as a summation, I would say that is grounded in age-old traditions of civil-military relations, of militaries that subordinate themselves to and therefore represent constitutional democratic republics, small r. We do what the nation tells us to do. Second, in reinforcing of the first, and so that comes from a tradition of American civil-military relations and the armed services professions, our ethic and our ethos. Reinforcing of that, I would say history tells us otherwise. Even our relatively short time on planet as the United States of America, as a nation state, history is replete with historical examples of the military doing what the nation required and what the conditions on the ground required in terms of what we call today phase four stability and reconstruction operations, military governorship type of operations. 12 years of reconstruction after the American Civil War is one of many examples of the United States military not only doing nation governorship and nation rebuilding and state rebuilding, but frankly, doing it really well. Frankly, doing it really well, particularly in those moments of high tension transition, moments where we're coming out of the so-called phase three major combat operational phases of any type of operation where the ground is still hot, right? We know we're no longer in major combat operations throwing lead at one another in a major and massive way, but we also know that we ain't in a moment of relative peace as we can come to know it. It's not a peace environment. It's an environment of what we might call of persistent imminent danger. It's a place where we, over the last 10, 15, 20 years, found ourselves at an exponential accelerative rate, losing peacekeepers, civilian non-governmental organizations, trying to do that from Doctors Without Borders to World Vision and everything in between, trying to do their peace operations, but in getting from the dock, say, the metaphorical dock and the figurative, the literal dock, you know, port, that's a benign space, in moving to a space of humanitarianism where they are going to deliver closed with to restore health and safety and security, that internecine space, the point from the space between point A and point B, a hot zone. I'm trying to remember back to the years I was doing some studies on this around the 2008-2010 period. And what compelled me into this research space were some of my friends on the humanitarian intervention side of the house, governmental and non-governmental, who had reached out to me and a few others because they were puzzled in the most tragic of ways of, you know, why they were all of a sudden having not only trouble getting to the humanitarian zone to conduct their operations, but dying at an 800% rate increase of taking casualties among themselves and trying to do the same missions that it seemed overnight had all of a sudden changed. It's because of these dynamics. And that was a time when, born of tragedy, as these unfortunately, these moments of innovation, mother necessity, you know, innovation born of mother necessity. And unfortunately, mother necessity tends to be critical crisis changes in the environment of conduct and malevolent activities and behaviors of competitors, adversaries, and enemies. So, not meaning to get too much off track here, but you know, those would be part of my two answers. History denies that counterfactual, that counterargument.
Great answer. Thank you. There's no good movies about phase four, though, unfortunately.
So. No, you know, it's not tough. You know, I've talked to some Hollywood friends of mine, you know, on the useful fiction front, you know, and, you know, I work with Peter Singer and August Cole in useful fiction. And, you know, they have a lot of great folks in Hollywood. I've talked to some of those folks about that very thing. So we need help. In fact, you guys have made it a little bit difficult for us to help our armed forces in, you know, maybe more particularly our special operations forces to begin to reconsider and redefine our organizational identity more consistent with the full 12 complement of the full 12 core competencies and core activities that define a special operations force leader operator, and to get out of the typecasting that Hollywood has helped really manifest of the four or five core tasks and activities that really defined the image of the special operator during the so-called global war on terrorism era, the 20 years of the GWAT, right? Direct action, capture, kill, in the night, reticle, halo, high altitude, low opening, drop, you know, Captain Phillips on the 3,000 meter shot in the dark on high seas, and then, you know, start playing the Proud to Be an American soundtrack in the background, right? That's sexy stuff, right? I mean, I'm a human being. I'm real. Yeah. You know, talking, no sexy music playing in the background. It's raining, muddy, crappy weather. You're somewhere nobody knows. No American really knows that the place even exists on the world map. And it's a couple of guys, you know, maybe inoculating goats as part of support to animal husbandry in places that, again, people can't recognize on the map, on the continent of Africa, as an example, or in the global south. That ain't sexy stuff, but it's at the primordial level where a relative peace can actually be conversated about, where conversations can be had about. You can build trust bonds and relationships that actually build resiliency, civil societies that may be and may have tendencies to be more relatively small d democratic than illiberal. That's really good, protracted work that, you know, our special operators, particularly our Green Berets, were born to do, as, you know, the current commander of U.S. Special Operations Command, General Brian Fenton, rightly reminds the irregular in the regular force of, born to do these things. Again, back to that previous question, our military does do Windows, and we do them very well. And if we have a sense of the new Windows to be built, the new nations and statehoods to be built on a compromised understanding of what the United States needs in terms of behavior from newly reborn statehoods and nationhoods, and most importantly, what those population groups need to resolve grievances, real and perceived, and to come out with better, more small d democratic-like social compacts of, for, and by themselves. It ain't sexy. It ain't the stuff of Hollywood. It's not going to be a blockbuster movie, but it's the stuff that ends endless wars and more often than not wins them without fighting.
Beautiful. Thank you. All right. So I'm going to take us forward to the 20-year mark, to the last piece that you've written that I want to cover, to sort of wrap us up on Iraq, and then we'll ask some big picture questions to close. So to refresh our listeners on the timeline, the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq at the end of 2011 is short-lived. In 2014, the Islamic State, commonly referred to as ISIS or ISIL, conducts an offensive across northern Iraq and Syria. In response, President Obama deploys U.S. forces throughout the region until formally ending the quote-unquote combat mission in Iraq in December 2021. So we've maintained some presence in the region to train, advise, and assist ever since. And last July, sir, you write a piece in Foreign Affairs titled, "What the U.S. Military Still Hasn't Learned from Iraq." So the floor is yours. What have we still not learned from Iraq?
Ooh, wow, that's a big one. How much time we got? We got a day and a half to let me blather on this one. So in December of 2011, when President Obama declared a formal end of America's war in Iraq, that was accurate from a military perspective, a U.S. military perspective, and a U.S. military perspective at the tactical, military tactical and military operational level, right? End of major combat operations. In fact, I think if we had said an ending of major combat operations, we would have been even more accurate in standing on solid terra firma, on solid ground. It haunts, and I don't want to beat this drum too hard, but there's a haunt between a December 2011 declaration of the end of America's war in Iraq and the May 2003 on the deck of the aircraft carrier, President Bush, at least in a banner that stood behind him, declaring by banner, mission accomplished, right? We now know, hindsight being better than 2020, that May of 2003 was maybe the end of our intended beginning, an intended ending on the war that we wanted a war in Iraq to be. But it was really in terms of the nature of the war, once initiated, it takes on its own natural life. Similar scenario with the December 2011 timeframe, I hate to say, end of our major combat operations until they had to begin again. So something's wrong here. It's certainly a tragic, but almost from an academic standpoint, a perfect experiment. We've got the same ground, similar condition state. The variable that we adjust, one would be an important one, unfortunately, for as realistic as reality is, a variable that matters to our polities. One blue Democrat administration and one red Republican administration. And both, we see the phenomenon, we see the paradox, we see the oxymoron alive in both periods. So what's going on here? And that's when a guy like me gets into organizational culture and institutional design, say-do gaps, right? Because that's stuff we can actually study and actually make changes to, make adjustments to. Can't really get into the strategic culture, especially in the acute moment. Can't get into the strategic culture and the minds of the deciders over a long period of time. If we get the organizational structures and organizational culture right, over long periods of time of education, unlearning and new learning from those dot mil PF changes over a long period of time, I am a big believer, or else I would not be a perpetual teacher. I do believe over time, we can affect a change in the cognitive understanding of where war, so-called war, ends and peace begins. Let me get to your question now. That was all preamble. Sorry, Gabe. I told you. This is a big one. I'm going to try to bend this for you. There's a lot to say on this. I'm going to try to neck it down. I'm going to give you a couple of taglines on what I think are the six big lessons gathered, but maybe not learned. And again, real quick, we love throwing around the term lessons learned. I would offer strongly that a lesson is not learned until it is integrated and accepted by the majority of the thinking and doing force as the agreed upon ways of doing the business. And those lessons gather are inculcated into institutional structures and organizational culture. That's a long story, not short of what a real lesson learned is. We have some from the Iraq experience, you know, on 20-year retrospective. I'm going to tell you real quick that I think of the big six. It'll give us enough summary to allow me to sleep at night because I have, of course, a whole hell of a lot more to say on this. First and foremost, you know, it's the article that came out in December of 2004 that, you know, as others say, almost got me court-martialed for revealing the truth on it. A lack of post-conflict planning. The U.S. military's failure to develop a comprehensive plan for Iraq's stabilization, not only after the initial combat operations, but more importantly, having that plan on the shelf prior to the initiation of the crossing of the berm. Second, inadequate communication between the military and our civilian leaders. And this is a tough one. This is a hard one. You know, at the time I'm writing this and studying this and speaking on it publicly, I'm a young major at the time back then, and it was very uncomfortable talking about it then. It's still uncomfortable to talk about now because I was not one of those 3- and 4-star generals, flag officers, in the quiet rooms, in the recesses where, and so I'm going to defer and say they were having those. And I know I've done some research since then in key informant interviews of folks who were in the room at the time, and there were those conversations. But at some point, those conversations have to become more public. And those conversations have to be persistent, and those conversations have to be prior to the line of to the line of departure, to the LD. And that's where I really fall. I would still say, as hard as it is for me to have to say it, the military did not sufficiently articulate its capabilities and limitations, and our limitations to the civilian, to the U.S. civilian authorities, which I think led to unrealistic expectations and objectives of an administration at the time who already came into it with unrealistic, unbounded expectations. Number 3 of 6, misunderstanding of local dynamics. A significant oversight, I would say, was our U.S. militaries, myself included, misapprehension of Iraq's cultural, religious, and ethnic complexities, which were equally important terrains in the conflict. I would say determinative terrains, right? That's where that whole conversation about kin-based understandings of the tribal relationships, the undercarriage, I would argue, in a place called Iraq, the longest standing and the most legitimate, even though it may rub American Western sensibilities in the wrong direction. It may rattle us because we don't ascribe to those types of public administration systems, but those are arguably where stuff gets done on a day-to-day basis. The road to hearts and minds is through wallets and stomachs. And how do you serve the public in a place, in an environment, the land of the Iraqis? Primordially, at fundamental bedrock level, through kin-based relationships, through familial relationships when you're talking about the Iraqi Kurds, and through tribes, right? The West, generally speaking, does not like tribes. It must become less than a like. You gotta dance with the ones that you're inviting yourself in to dance with, right? We did not do that. It took us a long time to catch up to that. And that slowed progress and added to the perpetuation of an endless series of warfares.
And sir, can I just ask a clarifying? So you're saying for some of our listeners who might be newer or uninitiated to the conflict, when you say tribes, you're going further than just Kurds, Shia, Sunni. You're going down further striations within those.
Absolutely.
Like a better understanding of those at these lower levels of the way people view kinship in community and where those kind of dividing lines would have perhaps helped us.
You're going into the DNA. At a proverbial DNA level of this. What we did as a practical example in northern Iraq, it took us a good 6 months, 4 to 6 months, starting early and recognizing this is what we need to do. How do we get the 101st Airborne Division, you know, 16,500 troops strong by a modified table of organizations and equipment by MTO? And within 3 months, we've ballooned up to outwards of 25 to 30,000 forces, because we've rolled in other USG agencies and we've rolled in, most importantly, indigenous forces in order to be a multinational division. And I'm going to use the word governorship over the 4 northern provinces of Iraq. What did we do when we first came into northern Iraq to set that up? We did what we always do. We established military operational boundaries. We carved up the northern provinces and we put them under control of one of our brigade combat teams. And then we further dissected areas of operation down through battalions, down to company, and even platoon levels. It took us a good 3 months to figure out our array of forces in the northern provinces are not aligned with the political boundaries of northern Iraq. So we made adjustments of our operational design to the political boundaries, state boundaries. Then we quickly realized, oh, wait a minute. We need to actually refine that down to the tribal level. And then you can take the echelon all the way down to kin-based and clan-based interrelationships. And I can show you a positive correlation between getting our footprint, our placement in the civil society of Iraq, the northern provinces, more right as a model to reality, and a positive correlation between that and positive returns on our close with to restore operations, as well as to our traditional close with to destroy terrorist organizations and their networks. But you first had to understand and not accept, but appreciate and respect how stuff gets done and through what political administrative apparatus. And then get that right within our own minds and get that right with in ways that don't force the United States, I'm going to focus on, but really the Western powers at large who are partnering with us as part of the coalition, how to understand and appreciate that, work within it, while at the same time not compromising our own value system. And that can be done because it has to be done and it must be done, right? So all the naysayers say, well, you know, that's great. It sounds like pie in the sky. It sounds like stuff that academics talk about. No, you know, I studied it as an academic and I led it and I planned it and I led it and helped implement it on the ground to positive effect. Look at the real historians who recorded this stuff. You don't have to listen to me. It worked. It is workable. It can and must be done. Right back to that earlier question. We'll blow up windows. We'll rebuild windows, nation state and nation building, and we'll clean the darn windows if that's what needs to be done, and especially if that's what our duly elected leaders from our bosses, the American public, tells us they want done.
I was just wondering how hard it must be to reframe. You're going into a place that you don't know and you have a picture of it, but the picture of it is what you've seen on a map with lines drawn that mean something to you, but don't mean nearly as much to the people on the ground who actually live there, right? They view their sense of self, their sense of state, community, et cetera, is a complete abstraction from probably what you're going into viewing this place as lines on a map. This is Iraq. This is the northern province. I mean, this might be a different conversation, but no,
it's a vitally important conversation. And now we're in the branches and sequels of the primary question, right? And this is stuff we've got to have more conversations like this with bigger and broader and more diverse audiences, because this is where the rubber meets the road. This is the stuff we got to understand and dialogue with each other about and go through the consternation and confusion and get through that, because this is stuff that's haunting us today. Yes, very difficult. Very difficult. You've got to start the study early. So just like when you're doing individual soldier, small unit, all the way up through collective training and education, officer development program, wedded into all that. Again, the collective training, we got to be adding this kind of dialogue, this kind of study. You can't just get the CIA country book on your way to the railhead.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
That ain't good enough. It's too little, too late for not long enough. Right? And we're putting those political factors last in line when they should be the determining and defining thing that brings us forward. Excuse my French. We've got it ass backwards. But that's when you understand mission as task and purpose instead of purpose and therefore the task. This is what it manifests. It's more than just semantic change. We should always focus on understanding a mission based on the purpose first. To what end? What's the political objective? And then and only then, what are the essential, the specified, and the implied tasks? Now you have a motivation to, oh, I better listen to those people that I'm here to protect and defend that I don't listen to. The indigenous population, I need to bring them in because they're going to make this real. Allies and partners, not just as a force multiplier, but as a true partner. We start cracking open the books again. When I flew over to Iraq my first and second time, I had two big tough boxes. The first one had military TA-50 military gear in it. The second was filled with books. And, you know, cut forward 15, 18 months later, a lot of the books that I brought over with me, not just for me, but for our plans team. Many of those were the same classic books that we found in the corners of Saddam Hussein's spider hole in the outskirts of Tikrit, because he was studying us. Right. Well, the operators that came to talk to my plans group a few weeks before we actually, the fourth ID pulled Saddam out of that spider hole, they came to talk with us as a plans group. And they, we laid out an idea. We laid out a proposition of where we might find him. And the plan we laid out for them was, follow the trail. How did Saddam Hussein come to power in the 60s in the first place, in the Baathists? Follow the trails, and there might be a most similar historical case comparative. And the proposition to put on the table was, he's probably gone back to ground, like a wounded animal. And he's going to go back to familiar ground. He's going to go back and use a lot of those same networks and those same places and safe houses that he probably in the Baathists used 40, 50 years prior to come to power. And I made a prediction. I said, if you follow this, you're probably going to find him within the next 2 months somewhere on this trail. And I was wrong. As any good planner is, no plan is right. They found him in 3 weeks, right on the trail. The prediction was wrong in terms of time. He was right where it was very noble. What were those trails? What were those partners? What were those supporters, those facilitators? All tribal.
Yeah.
All tribal. And it's not surprising that you're going to find Saddam Hussein al-Tikriti in and around Tikrit. Right? Come on.
That's incredible. That's incredible. That's a hook for the podcast right
all
there.
Knowable. All knowable.
That up front.
Let me just real quick.
Sorry. Yeah, please finish.
So lack of post-conflict planning, inadequate communication between military and civilian leaders, misunderstanding of local dynamics. I'm glad we've emphasized that one because it's cornerstone and bedrock. Inadequate force preparation. I would sum that up. Although the U.S. military had forces to take down Saddam Hussein's regime, we didn't have the adequate numbers, the combinations of forces, governmental and non-governmental, public, private, or the preparation of the same for the insurgency that followed. In fact, we weren't even allowed to call the situation of a rising insurgency formally an insurgency, and therefore our need to transition to a counterinsurgency operational profile and preparedness until November of 2003, when General Abizaid said it publicly for the first time. Up until then, there were prohibitions, informal and frankly, to some degree formal, of not calling that an insurgency. Because again, our national policy was, we're not here to do nation building and state building. Well, that's certainly the choice of our civilian masters in war policy to make that determination. But that determination can also be, in reality, in factual reality, wrong, right? It just worsened the say-do gap. Shortcomings of the military surge, right? I'm not taking anything away from the power and the promise that came out of the 2007 military surge. But I will emphasize that that surge was a military surge. And while the military surge was tactically successful in reducing violence, I would have to say it still failed to provide a lasting solution due to an overemphasis on military action over political and social engagement. I think that said, the military did what we could do at that point operationally in terms of what you can get done with a military surge. But it at best bought us a tactical and low operational interregnum. I would sum all that up into this point. Persistent challenges of modern warfare, Gabe. And what I tried to do with the article is I tried to point out that despite new military concepts and technologies, lessons gathered and learned technologically and conceptually at tactical and operational level, got a lot of that stuff, did learn a lot at that level in that context. Still, the U.S. military continues to struggle with integration into a coherent strategy for enduring peace. We need to have an idea of the relative peace, the political object that we are to attain, and then reverse design a campaigning forward way. That's really it in summation. And I would feel less comfortable saying that as an armchair quarterback, but having studied this and planned it and implemented it, I feel obligated. I not only feel humbly confident in saying this the way I'm saying it, but I feel equally humbly duty bound to continue to say it until we get this necessary piece more right. We find ourselves in these so-called endless wars, forever wars. We get to that point where we start to judge the goodness or the badness of continuing the fight based on protection of the force, of the military force. When risk to force, when risk to mission degrades down to risk to mission equals risk to force, regardless of whether you've achieved your objective or not, that's in state. That needs to be in state because you're now there largely as your purpose, protecting your own force. That's not the mission that we send troops forward for. And I can get a commander, a policymaker, a politician, a policymaker in the American public an A-plus on that exam question. If the mission is protect the force, redeploy.
While you're talking about it, I was going to kind of bring it up later, but as for what's next, I mean, soldiers still in Iraq. One of my former instructor pilots suffered a life-altering injury due to an attack by, you know, Iranian-backed militias. We had the three soldiers were killed, dozens more injured. Another Iran-backed militia drone attack in Jordan last month, I believe.
Yeah.
So what is the goal or the mission now as you see it? Because I don't think that that is clearly, it's either ill-defined or poorly communicated to the American people. And I'm in the Army and I'm asking the question, right? So I think as somebody who's been so close to this, what is your assessment of what that is now? Because it does feel like we're just protecting, there's a risk to force, obviously, and we're trying to protect ourselves from that. But I don't think it's immediately clear what the purpose is of being there. So I'd be curious sort of your candid assessment and answer to that.
Yeah. No, thanks for that question. I think you've already answered a lot of that question, and you're exactly right in what you've applied in terms of asking the question the way you did. You asking it as uniform, as a seasoned, combat seasoned, thinking doer, armed forces officer, and you're asking the question. It's clear that is more than an anecdote, because there's more than you, Gabe, asking that question within the uniformed force, within the officer corps of the uniformed force. At a place like West Point, teaching, educating, training, and inspiring future generations. If you're asking the question, to what end? Why are we there? That's clearly impoverished communication of mission through the force. And if we in the force don't know, aren't clear, then no one's clear. Certainly not the American public. They're not clear. Do I think the force that we have in the force arrayal and in the force numbers in both Iraq and in Syria, do I think there is a clear purpose in their being there in that preparedness and in that posture? I do. But my sense of that comes from 20 years of us getting there to here, right? And frankly, not only 20 years, but going back to the first Gulf War and looking at Gulf War I and so-called Gulf War II as a long war, as a continuum. And, you know, I'm haunted continually. He's been dead and gone a long time now, but Saddam Hussein back in 91, 92 put a haunting forewarning out that, you know, this is the mother of all battles. And it has been. Gulf War I was the mother of all battles, and we've helped to make it so. We've had as heavy a hand in making it so. Why we're there and where we are, I mean, lots of military, tactical, and operational purpose to task answers to that. But in the large P of purpose to those missions and the tasks that our forces are doing, it's presence to influence. It's part of deterrence in an integrated deterrence. It's a small force of presence to continue in practical, tactical, and low operational ways, the task of continue to train, advise, and assist both the Iraqi security forces and the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, in and throughout Syria, but mostly in northeastern and central eastern Syria. But from a theater strategic standpoint, having that presence, a minimum manned presence, that's enough to provide a proverbial hair trigger that signals to friends, enemies, and frenemies alike, don't tread on the Iraqis because we're still here. And that's a very valuable and very important mission. But where have you seen that articulated? I haven't. Right? To your point, it's not articulated. Maybe the reason why it's not articulated is because we're still approaching deployment and posturing and presence of military forces in the context of a use of military of armed force instead of declarations of use of force as part of ongoing wars. We're failing in our declaration in our declaratory roles and responsibilities, right? And it lends itself to confusion. And it perpetuates that thing I talked about a moment ago. It perpetuates undeniably, you know, given the purpose I've laid out, of why we're there and the numbers we are where we are, we're undoubtedly always a potential target to adversaries. And we've seen that in the context of responses to the Israel-Hamas war. So we've got to have that in context of, okay, if we have to have a clear understanding of why we're there politically, from a political object, a purpose of the reason, first and foremost, in order to have a resiliency of presence under attacks like this. Or we can immediately, we're so brittle there in our justifications and understandings of the purpose of why we're there, that can all of a sudden degrade down to mission is to protect our forces that are still in Iraq and Syria. If we've allowed the mission to become protection of the force still present in Iraq and Afghanistan as an in and of itself, get out of there. Get them out. Because we're not there with the right strategic mindedness and awareness of that we're there for a higher purpose. And the higher purpose is to provide an influence and an integrated deterrence, to add our piece of the integrated deterrence that keeps an Iran in a box, that keeps Islamic State 4.0 in a box, Al-Qaeda 4.0 in a box, keeps things, quote unquote, small c, contained and containable, right? It's not about force protection. You know, people will say, okay, this guy is sounding very callous. He doesn't care about U.S. troops. I've had soldiers die. I'm sure you have too. I've seen them die for cause and sometimes for not clear cause, right? And that's the most tragic piece. That's what makes declarations of not only of wars more importantly than just use of force. A clear declaration, particularly for democratic republics like ours, because once the public, once we come to an agreement that the cause is just and right and necessary and essential enough to send America's sons and daughters and all of our democratic allies and partners' sons and daughters forward, I don't mean this in a callous way, quite the contrary, but we've got to understand that we're sending them forward to protect and defend for something bigger than themselves, others in something bigger than themselves, and we're putting them in extreme harm's way with a higher probability of them not coming home again. Or if they do, coming home not fully complete. That's a serious proposition. And I'm not sure that we are being sober and serious enough in these determinations. Now where we are, we're in a very brittle moment, a very brittle place where we might find ourselves because we've allowed the mission purpose of those remaining troops, around 2,000 in Iraq, you know, or 800 or so in Syria, and around 2,000 or so in and around Iraq. A minimum force, a minimum effective force, if you understand the purpose of the thing. But with that being ambiguous again, we're putting ourselves to allow the Iranians and the Houthis to determine why we're there and for how long we're going to stay. Wrong. What about the purpose that had us maintaining that same force there up until the Iranians started supplying the Houthis indirectly for their attacks on our troops? We could find ourselves, the American public, underinformed and completely uninformed, saying, why the hell are we still there? No one's told me in quite a while. And we're seeing America's sons and daughters coming back home in flag-draped caskets again? No. Where the answer may be 2,800 in those two places strategically prevent tens and hundreds of thousands of more troops having to go in. It's a similar situation, though not with American direct blood and, you know, boots on the ground, but in terms of our commitments through money and materiel to Ukraine. It brings an affordability question too prematurely and too out of context to the forefront. It blinds us from asking the real affordability question. Can we afford not to do it? What are the consequences of not being there?
We had a previous episode on this podcast where a guest sort of implored U.S. leaders to stop framing that particular conflict as a democratic charity case in favor of messaging the very practical and almost self-serving reasons why support to Ukraine is in our best interest. As we wrap up here, I almost get a sense that all these wars and conflicts post-World War II, while each very different in their own ways, we see these same echoing themes. Ends, ways, and means mismatching to political end states, phase four planning, and of course the challenge of messaging, as you put it, purpose and task to the American people who support the American soldier.
You know, I talk about in my book from 2007-13, Thinking Beyond War, you know, I start that book with, you know, trying to see a peace beyond our wars. And I start with a reflection on my father's own war experiences, both theaters of World War II, Korea, and two tours in Vietnam, right? He and my mother reside in Arlington National Cemetery. comes back, clear win in the first war, his first war, World War II, the nation's first war, both theaters. Comes back a little confused because of Korea. Didn't call it a war, a police action, right? Didn't call it what it is, what was then and what it continues to be now, the longest standing armistice. I would say second to the American Civil War, but a longstanding armistice. That's a whole nother podcast. And the third one, Vietnam, two tours, an unmitigatable loss, and a loss that was blamed on the soldiers because the nation and the political leaders, the nation didn't understand well enough, and the political leaders were culpable in trying to find a scapegoat, and they allowed that scapegoat, either deliberately sin of omission or commission, but still a sin nonetheless, to fall on the shoulders of veterans. We're still losing the Vietnam War today because we're still losing Vietnam veterans to self-medication, suicide, endemic homelessness, et cetera, et cetera. We're only at the beginning of this for the wars of Iraq and Afghanistan. We're only at the beginning of this. So I would end with that. We've got to exercise ourselves as the ghosts of our fathers and mothers' wars. But we have to do better for nation, not self. So appreciate the opportunity, Gabe.
Thank you for listening to the Social Science of War podcast. This podcast was brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. If you enjoyed the episode, please consider subscribing, leave a rating and comment, and most importantly, please share the Social Science of War with others. One final note, what you heard in this episode does not represent the views of West Point or any other agency of the U.S. government.